Good afternoon. My name is Iftikhar Dadi. I'm the interim director of Cornell's South Asia program. It's a very great pleasure to welcome you all today for the South Asia program's annual Tagore lecture. This is one of our favorite events of the South Asia program, typically scheduled early in the fall term in order to brighten our return to campus. In the late 1990s, Cornell Professor Emeritus of Operations and Industrial Research, Narahari Umanath Prabhu and his wife, Mrs. Sumi Prabhu, who are sitting right in front here, initiated a generous gift to Cornell University, establishing the Rabindranath Tagore Endowment in Modern Indian Literature. The Rabindranath Tagore Endowment was created by Professor and Mrs. Prabhu in order to honor Rabindranath Tagore, a celebrated writer and musician, and one of the sort of the great luminaries of 19th and 20th centuries, in South Asia and the world, really. In addition with their endowment, Professor and Mrs. Prabhu sought to, and I quote, project a strongly positive image of South Asian literature, end quote. And this included nonfiction, prose, poetry, and fiction from India and other locations in both national and the English language, national languages and the in English language. Professor Prabhu's commitment to supporting exposure to the arts of South Asia stems from a commitment from his long-standing emotional and philosophical engagement with the prose, poetry, and music, including centrally the writings and music of Rabindranath Tagore. This year's lecture was planned by my colleague, Anne Blackburn, the director of the South Asia program, who is on study leave this year, but is in the audience. Okay. and so it's all her doing, okay? I take no credit for inviting our speaker and for the wonderful choice. So she is normally the director of the South Asia program, but she's on leave, study leave this year, and I'm serving as interim director during 2015-2016. Anne Blackburn, who has noted that in her, and I quote, conversations with Professor and Mrs. Prabhu, it became apparent quickly that their house was one in which books and music were really friends of the family. I remember some lovely moments in their living room discussing the work and merits of several authors writing on and from South Asia, end quote. And as our former program director, Professor Alaka Basu, and her husband, Professor Kaushik Basu, have remarked earlier, Professor and Mrs. Prabhu deserve deep appreciation and thanks from the Cornell community for this generous gesture of the yearly Tagore lecture. For those of us who know them personally, however, the lecture is just one thing. What we have got to appreciate and enjoy over the years is the long discussions on art, culture, and literature that they are always eager to begin and keep going. And it's particularly striking how this love of literature has made them good human beings in the best sense of the word, open to their worldviews, tolerant of other points of view, interested in other people and in other people's story. It is in these times of intolerance and violence, it is wonderful to find in them this eagerness to know and understand the variety of human experience, end quote. I know that Professor and Mrs. Prabhu are deeply pleased to make possible today's Tagore lecturer, Muhammad Hanif, who joins an impressive array of Tagore lecturers. And these have really included, you know, speakers, distinguished writers and translators and academics from across South Asia, which includes Indian writers, Bangladeshi writers, Nepali writers, and today we have Muhammad Hanif. Muhammad Hanif was born in Okada in Pakistan. He graduated from the Pakistan Air Force Academy as a pilot officer, but subsequently left to pursue a career in journalism. He's a graduate of the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England. And in 1996, he moved to London to work for the BBC. He initially worked for the Karachi-based monthly Newsline and wrote for the Washington Post, India Today, and also extensively for the Guardian. Later, he became head of the BBC's Urdu World Service. in London. He moved back to Pakistan in 2008. He has written plays for the stage and the screen, including a critically acclaimed BBC drama and the feature film, The Long Night. Hanif's first book, A Case of Exploding Mangoes, was published in 2008, was shortlisted for the 2008 Guardian First Book Award and longlisted for the 2008 Man Booker Prize. It won the 2009 Commonwealth Book Prize in the Best First Book category, and also the 2008 Shakti Bhatt First Book Prize. Hanif's second book, or Lady of Alice Bhatti, was published in 2011. It was shortlisted for the Wellcome Trust Book Prize in 2012 and for the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature in 2013. His plays include, the title is What Now? Now That We Are Dead, which was a radio play, and also The Dictator's Wife. He's currently working on an opera, collaborating with a composer based in New York City. And I, you know, having known his writing through his fictional as well as his non-fictional work, I think you know, it's very appropriate to say that Muhammad Hanif's voice is one of great bravery, courage, and principle. And for speaking on behalf of women, religious and ethnic minorities, and for the disenfranchised generally, such as the residents of Balochistan in Pakistan today, which are under persecution by the state forces, and also by Christians and women under attack by various patriarchal and majoritarian agendas. This is at a time when brave voices are needed more than ever, not just in Pakistan, but in South Asia and the world. He is truly a public intellectual, equally comfortable writing in English and in Urdu, and combines a sharp political and social understanding with his characteristic wit, satire, and humor. Today, Muhammad Hanif honors us with his presentation of the South Asia Program's annual Tagore Lecture. Please join me in welcoming him.
Hi, thanks for coming, and thanks for having me here. I'm going to read a bit, and then hopefully after that we can have a conversation. I'm going to read about some places. First, I'm going to read about some apartments. Then I'm going to read about a cage. Then, if we still have time, I'm going to read about a tree and probably a hospital ward. The first piece is called, rather shamelessly, Seven Places in My Heart and One in My Art. There are some subheads which are in Urdu. I'm not going to translate them. Just ask the person sitting next to you. That might help. This piece is about all the little shabby places that I've lived in Karachi when I moved there first. Aage Samandar Hai. Your first home in Karachi is a little room in a big empty house near Sea View. The owners live in Norway, the servants live in the house, and you live in a little extension that was probably meant to accommodate those servants. You have one bag of clothes and books, a cassette player, and three tapes. You drive a Suzuki 100 that you bought from a milkman. This is the first time in your life that you are living close to the beach. Judging by the stench in the evening, it seems half of Karachi's population has pissed in the sea. At night, you wake up to the roar of the waves. For a few moments, you're scared. Is this a giant screaming? Is it a tornado approaching? Is this what grown-up life is like? A pair of Bengali servants, you'll never discover their exact relationship, take care of the house. To your lonely heart, it seems they've been hired to canoodle in every corner of the house. They seem so much in love with each other, it frightens you. You wonder if you should have rented that premises in Baloch Colony, where the owner promised that the water pump was situated only one street away, and it would be okay if you wanted to keep goats. Your sustenance comes from one little bottle of Fanta and a large fruit bun. You take a bite, you take a sip, you kickstart your bike and roar into the city. One day, you pick up the bun and see fungus growing on it. You start spending your nights in Sabzi Mandi. The second place is called Sabzi Mandi Ki Sair. Without ever asking or telling, you move in with a friend who lives in a room in a private school right next to Sabzi Mandi. The school has rented a room to this new arrival in town, who is a reformed druggie, a recovering socialist, and a struggling theater artist. You wake up to the cackle of 1,000 children in white shirts. It's a bit like living in the middle of a poultry farm. You can't really get out of your room till the kids go home, but after school and on the weekends, you are king of the establishment. The basketball hoops are yours, and so is the headmaster's office. You do the rounds of Sabzi Mandi at night, not really looking for vegetables. People come from all over Pakistan, and you get to sample the diverse gifts they bring and share generously. Your new friends in the neighborhood are embarking on their political careers. One stops by to ask if he can borrow a churidar pajama as he has to report for duty at 9:00. People's Party boys tell you that the only way to get the PPP leaders to accept their demands is to wield a US flag and a matchbox, preferably when cameras are around. After school hours, the school sometimes turns into a gambling den, a drug lab, and a rendezvous point for friends of friends for a bit of random love. You come back from work and count 5 used condoms strewn around the place. You feel melancholic. A friend arrives from one of the backward districts of Punjab and brings with him a stereo so huge that all of you can't fit in the same room. Empress Market Ke Badshah. You think you're on the top of the world because you find a flat on the top floor of an 8-story building that overlooks Karachi Grammar School. You hire a maid who some days has to make 25 chapatis because it seems all the drifters from the Punjab's backwaters have congregated here. Sometimes there's nothing to go with the chapatis except yogurt. You go to work where your office tea boy is a 55-year-old who lives with 18 cats in a tiny shack. He used to be a butcher once. He shows you his sliced thumb to prove it. He would like to get back to his old profession. One evening, a dreaded gentleman from your past barges in with a woman with very large eyes and a chador. His claim to fame is that he has slept with 263 women. He keeps a diary. He has shown you the diary. You're rude to him and make sure that the woman doesn't become 264th in your flat. You like being the moral police. You come back very late from work one night and Empress Market Square is resounding with the beat of drums and dozens of Pashtuns in a circle doing their dance. You've seen that Khatak dance on TV. The circle parts for you and you join in. They all think you're a faggot. Meanwhile, your tentative housemate's tentative girlfriend threatens to throw herself out of the window. The place is clearly way above your budget. Kashmir Road Ke Mehman, Azadi Ya Maut. You live as a paying guest at a famous poet's rambling mansion on Kashmir Road. Your head spins as you enter your room. The room is circular. The bathroom looks like an igloo from the outside. Your life turns into a bizarre set of events. You adopt a street puppy which is kidnapped. You rescue it and then abandon it. You start meeting boys from Natha Khan Goat who run a theater group. It seems the goat is populated by theater enthusiasts. They are so smart they can look at your ashtray and tell your future. They tell your future belongs in Natha Khan Goat. Natha Khan Goat mein Nautanki. The only window in your flat overlooks a sandbag bunker belonging to the Rangers and a chapri kebab shop. You are 1 minute off Drigg Road, but it seems you are in a village that can't decide whether it prefers a traffic jam or a curfew. You start writing and rehearsing a play. In it, there are to be 9 boys and a girl. You ask your thespian comrades, "Aur ladki kahan se aayegi?" You manage to find your female character. She starts going out with the best actor in the group. The second best actor starts spreading malicious rumors about them. The best actor borrows a TT pistol from someone. Borrowing a TT pistol in Natha Khan Goat is easier than borrowing a bicycle or getting a girl to act in a play. wanting to shoot the second best actor. The best actor hides behind some props. You remind them that there's no shooting in the script. Some troubled friends from the backwater districts of Punjab decide to use your flat as a rehab center. Not a good idea. Drugs in Natha Khan Ghat are as easy to get, as cheap, and as delicious as the chapli kebabs just below your apartment. They sell drugs that help you rid yourself of the addiction to other drugs, and then they sell you opium to get over all those drugs they sold you earlier. And you thought opium was so 18th century. The best actor gets married to the only girl in the play and disappears. The second best actor goes on to win many best actor awards. You think that's as close to a happy ending as your group is likely to get. Sea Breeze Plaza may sea breeze. There is an apartment building on Drigg Road that has always looked like a giant Dunhill packet to you. A crime reporter on a Karachi Eveninger rents you his 18th floor studio flat. The building is as frail and as injurious to health as a cigarette packet. The lift goes up to the 14th floor, and then you walk up. You are the only resident between the 14th and 18th floor. You wanted your solitude. Here you have it. You also find out for the first time that what they mean when they describe the view from your window as breathtaking. You also learn why the building is called Sea Breeze Plaza. It's because the building sways and dances to the sea breeze at night. One morning, you wake up to find out that your sink has fallen on the WC and the WC has crashed into the window. There's nothing left between you and the breathtaking view. Nature is not the only enemy here. One morning, you find bullet casings in your room. Did you not hear the firing in Lines area last night, you're told? Don't worry, nobody's trying to kill you, just stray bullets. You finally get around to doing a play. It involves a lot of masks. Friends who didn't find love in Natha Khan Ghat sit around for days molding large plastic sheets into wolves and tigers and rabbits. A lush old ustad who runs a firewood stall by day comes to help out with the music. One night, he's in too good a mood. He grabs your hand and stands on the window ledge, announcing to everyone that we'll jump down and nothing will happen because his music is pure, he has spiritual powers. You look down and take in the breathtaking view. No spiritual power has ever rescued you, but you don't want to disagree with an ustad as you're standing over a window on the 18th floor. He offers you a way out. Give me a kiss. You look down, then you kiss him. Never say no when a senior artist who is drunk and has spiritual powers is standing on the ledge of an 18th floor window in a building that sways in the sea breeze. Studio K. Shabaroz. You get a ground floor studio flat with a little kitchenette in a commercial area in Defense. You've just spent some time in Washington, D.C. and then in Havana. You buy a bicycle and ride to work. You start drinking black coffee and learn to make chutneys. Your friends think you're a lifestyle slut. The fact is that you have no money for a motorbike and can't afford to eat out. Then a leasing company pays you a visit and you sign a paper. Suddenly you have a big TV, a VCR, and an air conditioner. Your barren little studio is suddenly full of stuff. You become a regular at a video shop called Movie Mahal, where all below-the-counter movies are appropriately titled National Geographic. Sometimes, when you venture out of your player palace, you find the streets deserted. You have no idea that you're walking into a curfew. Then a police mobile sees you and starts shooting. You run back to your studio. You try to write plays. There are lots of girls who want to do plays. And then you live in a dead poet's house and learn to read. The life lesson that you will learn in this damp Zamzama apartment, you will learn from a prostitute. But before that, you discover a world of wonder. Your new flat was owned by a poet who died young. The place has nothing but books. Many times, thumb books, read with love, passages underlined, reactions noted, little slips of paper with cross references inserted, obscure words circled and explained. Here, your housemates are Borges, Calvino, and Muhammad Khalid Akhtar. You've always read books, but you've never really learned to read like this. Here, each book you pick up comes with the gentle guidance of your late landlord, Saghir Malal. He tutors you from beyond. He teaches you the bleeding obvious. You can't ride if you don't know how to read. Then one day, your occasional housemate goes out and comes rushing back with two women. Outside, there is a curfew, and the women need shelter for a while. They have come all the way from Krungi 6 to meet some clients who seems to have disappeared. One is a tall, dark Amazonian character with wild laughter and wants you to write her tragic love story. She comes from a backward district of Punjab. The other one is a short and confident woman and wants to make a few phone calls to try and make contact with other potential clients. Aren't you scared of roaming around in the middle of this curfew? So far away from home, you ask. The tall one thinks that not only do you have no money, you are also stupid, and replies in her backward district's mother tongue, it's work, you get screwed, you get paid, what's there to be scared of? Thank you. This piece is about a cage and it's called Shehzadi. As the first snow of the season fell in Lalazar, a lush green valley in northern Pakistan, the zookeepers began to starve their only inmate, Shehzadi, a 3-year-old snow leopard. A team of half a dozen men walked up a narrow mountain trail, carrying on their shoulders a small cage attached to two long poles. They put a few dead chickens in the small cage, put the small cage next to a hatch door in the large cage, and opened the door. The famished Shehzadi followed the smell of food and walked into the small cage. The hatch door behind her clanged shut. The men lifted the cage on their shoulders and started walking down to the mountain road where a truck awaited. This truck would take her to a zoo in Abbottabad, a town in the plains about 100 kilometers away. It doesn't snow in Abbottabad, and this would be Shehzadi's home for the winter months. The snow leopard would be taken away from Lalazar for exactly the period of time that it snows there. We journalists, faced with such situation, tend to shout out the word irony. I didn't see any irony here, only confinement, torture, and plain old-fashioned brutality. I had caught a glimpse of Shehzadi one day as she took a siesta towards the end of summer last year. She was cajoled out of her little bunker by a bunch of noisy children. She was as beautiful as the snow-peaked mountains in the distance. I'm not much of an animal lover. The only opinion that I hold about them is that they be allowed to live, well, like animals. Shehzadi was housed in a cage no more than 150 feet long and 70 feet wide. Shehzadi stretched her body lazily. Ripples went through its black spotted fur. Its immense tail looked like a separate creature. Then this wild beast, known for being shy and elusive, started to behave like a domestic pet. It put its back to the iron bars, and children, encouraged by the zookeeper, started to tickle it. The children ran along the cage, and Shehzadi ran with them like a dog playing catch in a park. The zookeeper told me that a snow leopard can run at a speed of 100 kilometers per hour, and here she was just indulging the children. Shehzadi also probably knew that whatever speed that she ran at, she will hit the cage wall after 150 feet. Then, bored with this child play, she started to leap at the cage walls, rattling them with her huge paws. For a few moments, it wasn't just the cage, but also the surrounding mountains that seemed to tremble with her wild rage. Scared, the children backed away and started taking pictures with their mobile phones. Sometimes, she can be very playful. The zookeeper showed me scratches on his forearms. After a few minutes, she skulked back into her bunker. The word Shehzadi means princess, and it's a common name for girls all over Pakistan. This particular Shehzadi was imported by the son of a powerful politician and was meant for his private zoo. The customs impounded it, the news was leaked to the media, and in a rare case of law-abiding, the father refused to defend his son's illegal hobby. The snow leopard was handed over to the wildlife department. They named it Shehzadi and decided to house it in the middle of a beautiful valley called Lalazar. A large cage was constructed, a nominal ticket price was decided, a canteen sprung up, another cage was built for future expansion of the zoo, anti-littering signs were put up, and slowly a small tourist economy was in place. These days, Lalazar is under 10 feet of snow. In Abbottabad, where Shehzadi is spending her winter, the temperature is 20 degrees Celsius. Why must a snow leopard be kept away from snow? Because in Lalazar, it would be almost impossible to feed her. The trail leading up to her cage is narrow and difficult. The wildlife department doesn't have the resources to take care of her in the winter. So the simple answer is, Shehzadi has to be taken away from snow for her own good. For a moment, I wondered if this was a metaphor for our current troubles, that we must be bombarded from the skies by drones and attacked by our own militants in our own streets, all for our own good. But we are not snow leopards, and Shehzadi's fate is no metaphor. If someone was to open the door of that cage, what would happen? If Shehzadi can really run as fast as they say she can, within a couple of hours, she'll be up on those mountains where snow never melts. Animal lovers might worry that after a long time in captivity, she would find it difficult to survive in the wild. I don't have the answer, but we are not the snow leopards in the story. Shehzadi is. She would know how to survive in snow. This next little piece is about a tree. A very dear friend and a young artist hanged himself a few years ago in Karachi. And I was very disturbed. And I used to walk around the neighborhood looking for signs to explain this to myself. A short walk away from where Asim once kept a studio, I started seeing old Clifton's oldest trees sprouting large eyes, snakes painted on the branches, and a whole pavement exploding with messages in brightly colored geometric patterns, and long lines of colorful digits that seemed like cell phone numbers for other galaxies. I met the artist. I met Ayub the artist around a log fire in the Clifton Park. A log fire might seem excessive for Karachi's mild winter, but if you live in a public park, you really need it on certain nights. The other people around the fire were the dudes who washed cars all day and were sometimes accused of stealing hubcaps. They came around with little offerings, a bun kebab, a kilo of mutton, a fish they claimed to have caught, a quarter from Azad's wine shop. They sat and listened in rapt attention as the artist regaled them with completely made-up stories about prophets, valleys, and a giant computer that runs the world. Occasionally, he slipped in a comment about the state of the nation. Half of us are thieves, he said at one point, and the other half are deployed to beat drums and shout, thief, thief, thief. When I decided that I needed to ask him some questions about his wall and tree work, I thought I should visit him in the morning, have some questions ready, make it sound like work. I did have some questions. When did you first start painting? Does the eject sign painted by another dead friend mean anything to you? Why do you paint on hubcaps and trees and walls? I thought maybe I should take an offering of paints and brushes. I found him folding his bedding and yawning inside the hollowed-out trunk of a tree so old that it looked like the oldest uncle in the family of Hungarian trees. He was shivering slightly. Morning is a bit cold. I bent down and shook his head, pretending I regularly visited people who had just woken up inside a tree. He recognized me. I have been a big fan of Italo Calvino's The Baron and the Trees, in which a young boy, after scolding from his father, climbs up a tree and spends the rest of his life on trees, never again setting a foot on this earth. But even that book had not prepared me for dealing with an acquaintance living inside a tree. My questionnaire seemed redundant. What was I going to ask him? Why do you live inside a tree? What if he asked me why I didn't live inside a tree? What if he asked me if I could recommend a better tree to live in? We should probably meet when it's not so cold. In the evening, there's work to be done. He waved towards a boy who was making tea on a makeshift stove. I saw a collection of half-painted wheel caps, a large eye on the tree trunk that he's used as his bedroom, an intrinsically painted wooden box that, on an earlier visit, he had proclaimed to be the State Bank of Pakistan, and the long, wavy snakes on the branches of tree. The small railing that ran along the pavements had strange, symmetrical patterns that looked like a desert dweller's idea of what the real world should look like. The artist who lives in a tree talks in riddles that are so obvious that everyone understands. Benazir Bhutto once told me that I have to wash other people's clothes. They're the only way I can buy my opium. Then he lets on a rare personal sight. I worked for Adam G. Insurance Company as a sales manager once. It seemed I was working for my father, Adam. For some reason, the conversation turns to politics, and he explains how the caretaker government of the universe works. We just keep blaming the army. This army has been recruited from orphanages. Why blame the orphans, he said. And I'm going to read a little bit about a hospital ward. It's an excerpt from a book I wrote a few years ago. It's called Our Lady of Alice Bhatti. In this particular chapter, a young man called Teddy Butt is in love with the main protagonist of the book, Alice Bhatti, but he doesn't quite know how to show her love, as some men don't have that kind of talent. So he has a... So he does what people in Karachi do. Teddy has brought a Mauser to his declaration of love. He's brought a story about the disappearing moon as well, but he's not sure where to start. The story is romantic in an old-fashioned kind of way. The Mauser has three bullets in it. He's hoping that the Mauser and the story about the moon will somehow come together to produce the kind of love song that makes old acquaintances run away together. Before resorting to gunpoint poetry, Teddy Butt tries the traditional route to romancing a medical professional. He pretends to be sick, and then, like a truly hopeless lover, starts believing that he is sick. Recognizes all the little symptoms, sudden fevers, heart palpitations, lingering migraine, even mild depression. He cries while watching a documentary about a snow leopard stranded on a melting glacier. He lurks around the OPD on a Sunday afternoon when Sister Alice Bhatti is alone. She pretends to be busy counting syringes, boiling needles, polishing grimy surfaces, and only turns around when he coughs politely, like you're supposed to do when entering a respectable household, so that the women have the time to cover themselves. Sister Alice Bhatti doesn't understand this polite cough protocol and stares at him as if telling him, "See, this is what smoking does to your lungs." Teddy Butt is too vain to bring up anything like stomach troubles or a skin rash, both conditions he frequently suffers from. Boldabolics play havoc with his digestion. His bodybuilder's weekly regime of waxing his body hair has left certain parts of his body looking like abstract Klim designs. For his first consultation with Sister Alice, he is thought up of something more romantic. "I can't sleep." He says this, sitting on a rickety little stool as Sister takes notes in a khaki register. "For how long have you not been able to sleep?" With any other patient, Alice would have reached for the wrist to take the pulse, would have listened to their chest with a stethoscope, but with patient Teddy, she knows that he's not that kind of patient. "Since I've seen you," is what Teddy wants to say, but he hasn't rehearsed it. He's not ready yet. "I actually do go to sleep, but then I have dreams and I wake up," he says, and feels relieved at having delivered a full sentence without falling off the stool. Alice Bhatti wants to tell him to go to the OPD in Cheriyawad. That's where they deal in dreams. The whole place is a bad dream. But she knows that he wants to be her patient And Sister Hina Alvi has taught her that when a patient walks in with intent, you still listen to them, even if you know they're making up their symptoms. She presses on with her diagnosis. She can also see the outline of a muzzle in the crotch of his yellow Adidas trousers. He looks like a freak with two cocks. What kind of dreams? Teddy has only ever had one dream, the one with a river and a kaftan-wearing god in it. The dream always ends badly as a drowning Teddy discovers that he can't walk on water even in his dream. God stands at the edge of a silvery, completely walkable river and shakes his head in disappointment as if saying, "It's your dream, what do you expect me to do?" But somehow, in this potentially romantic setting, bringing up God and his kaftan and his disapproval seems inappropriate. "I see a river in my dream," he conveniently leaves God out. "A river?" Alice Betty taps the pen on a register without writing anything. Teddy feels he's being told that his dream is not sick enough. "It's a river of blood, red." Alice looks at him with interest. This Teddy boy might be a police tout, but he has a poetic side to him, she thinks. "Any boats in that river of yours?" she asks with an encouraging smile, as if urging him to go on sharing more of his dream with her, to go ahead and dream for her. Teddy accepts the challenge. "It has bodies floating in it and severed heads bobbing up and down." He realizes that his dream doesn't sound very romantic. "And some flowers also." "Do you recognize any of these people in the river, in your dream, I mean?" Teddy shuts his eyes as if trying hard to recognize a face from the river. Teddy was hoping that somehow his midnight yearning for Alice and his insomnia would walk hand in hand and form a rhyming, soaring declaration of love that would reverberate through the corridor of the hospital. Instead, he's stuck with embellishing details of a bad dream. "I can't really stop your dreams, but I can give you something that will ensure that you sleep well. And if you sleep well, then you might start having better dreams." He scribbles a prescription for Lexotinil, then puts it aside. "Actually, I might have some here. An hour before you sleep, never on an empty stomach, and no warm milk at night. Sometimes indigestion can give you bad dreams." Alice gives a brief smile. "You might want to change that bandage on your thumb. I hope you didn't hurt it in a dream." Then she turns around and goes back to counting her syringes. She does it with such studied concentration that it seems the health of the nation depends on getting this count right. So they go on for a bit. I'll race towards the end of this love scene. The final bell rings in the neighboring St. Xavier's Primary School, and 1,800 children suddenly start talking to each other in urgent voices like house sparrows at dusk. Alice Patti bends down, picks up the piss tray from the floor, and holds it in front of her chest. She speaks in Mayid tones. "I know your type," she says. "That little gun doesn't scare me. Your tears don't fool me. You think that a woman, any woman who wears a uniform, is just waiting for you to show up and she'll take it off. I wish you had just walked in and had the guts to tell me that you want me to take this off. We could have had a conversation about that, at the end of which I would have told you what I'm telling you now. Fuck off and never show me your face again." Teddy but flees before she's finished. He runs past the legless man taking a nap with his face covered with an X-ray, past the ambulance drivers dissecting the evening newspapers, past the hopeful junkies waiting for the hospital to accidentally dispense its bounty. As he emerges out of the hospital, he raises his arm in the air and without thinking, without targeting anything, fires his Mauser. The city stops moving for 3 days. The bullet pierces the right shoulder of a truck driver who has just entered the city after a 48-hour-long journey. His shoulder is almost leaning out of his driver's window, his right hand drumming the door, his fingers holding a finely rolled joint, licked on the side with his tongue for extra smoothness, a ritual treat that he's prepared for the end of the journey. He's annoyed with his own shoulder. He looks at it with suspicion. His shoulder feels as if it had been stung by a bee that has traveled with him all the way from his village. His left hand grips the shoulder where it hurts and finds his shirt soaked in red gooey stuff. He jams the brake pedal to the floor. A rickshaw trying to dodge the swerving truck gets entangled in its double-mounted Goodyear tires and is dragged along for a few yards. Five children, all between 7 and 9, in their pristine blue and white St. Xavier's uniforms, become a writhing mess of fractured skulls, blood, crayons, and Buffy the Vampire Slayer lunchboxes. The truck comes to a halt after gently nudging a cart and overturning a pyramid of the season's last guavas. A size 4 shoe is stuck between two Goodyears. School notebooks are looked at, pockets are searched for clues to the victim's identity. The mob slowly gathers around the truck. Petrol is extracted from the tank and sprinkled over its cargo of 3 tons of raw peanuts. Teddy, with his broken heart, and the truck, with his bleeding shoulder, both realize what's coming even before the mob has made up its mind. They first mingle in the crowd and then start walking in opposite directions. A lonely fire engine will turn up an hour later, but will be pelted with stones and sent away. The truck and its cargo will smolder for 2 days. In a house 20 miles away, a phone rings. A grandmother rushes onto the street, beating her chest and wailing. 2 motorcycles kickstart simultaneously. 6 jerry cans full of kerosene are hauled onto a rickety Suzuki pickup. A 19-year-old rummages under his pillow, cocks his TT pistol, and runs onto the street screaming, promising to rape every Pathan mother in the land. A second-hand tire shop owner tries to padlock his store, but the boys are already there with their iron bars and bicycle chains. A police mobile switches its emergency horn and rushes towards the police commissioner's house. A helicopter hovers over the beach as if defending the Arabian Sea against the burning rubber smell that is spreading through the city. An old colonel walking his dog in the colonel's colony asks his dog to hurry up and do its business. A bank teller is shot dead for smiling. Finding the streets deserted, group of kites and crows descend from their perches and chase wild dogs who lift their faces to the sky and bark joyously. 5 size 4 coffins wait for 3 days as ambulance drivers are shot at and sent back to where they came from. Carcasses of burnt buses, rickshaws, pawn shops, and at least one KFC joint seem to have a calming effect on the city. Newspapers start predicting normalcy limping back to the city as if normalcy had gone for a picnic and sprained an ankle. During the 3-day shutdown, 11 more are killed. 2 of them turn up shot and tied together in 1 gunny bag dumped on a rubbish heap. 3 billion rupees worth of Suzuki's, Toyota's, and Hino Park are burnt. During these days, Alice Bhatti is actually not that busy. When people are killed while fixing their satellite dishes on their roofs, or their motorbikes are tossed while they're going to buy a liter of milk, they tend to forget about their minor ailments. They learn to live without dialysis for their kidneys, home cures are found for minor injuries, prayers replace prescription drugs. Alice has time to sit down between her chores, time to take proper lunch and prayer break. Between cleaning gunshot wounds and mopping the A&E floor, Sister Alice has moments of calm, and she finds herself thinking about that scared man with the Mauser, his mad story about the disappearing moon. She wonders if he's caught up in these riots, if he's still having those dreams. She wonders if she has been in one of his dreams. On the 4th day, a fisherman bicycles slowly through the rubble with a wicker basket brimming with his homemade fishing net. With his back to the city, he dips his toe in the seawater, likes its cold, warm, cold feel, rolls up his trousers, and starts laying his net for the night. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Will you take questions or comments from the audience?
Yeah, sure.
Who inspired you to start writing?
Boredom, I guess. Other writers, I guess. As a kid, you start reading, and you keep reading. And then one day you're kind of, one day you're stupid and arrogant enough and you think that maybe I can try and do this this too. I think that's probably how it works with most people who write. I think they're readers to begin with, and you keep reading and keep reading and keep reading, and then, you know, sort of you have these delusions that you might have something to say, you might have a story to tell.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I've read some of your articles online, and I'm wondering, your political articles, if you've had any threats, or, I'm sure you've had controversies, but, and then, why you chose, because of your stand or your views, and perhaps threats, why you chose to move back to Karachi. Do you feel safer in Karachi than in London?
I think, why can't people just forget about that? Why do they keep reminding you that? I think even Iftikhar Sahab was saying in his introduction something about my bravery. And I think that's a really frightening thing to say about someone, because when you say that someone is brave, you're basically telling that they have no clue what they're doing. that they're stupid enough to be doing this. So I generally object to that kind of description. I mean, you've written something, there are various ways of saying something about it. You can say that it's good, I liked it. You can say it made no sense. You can say, you know, sort of it's completely superficial and has no great insight. But to say that it's brave actually kind of puts the person in kind of, you know, that, oh, you are definitely marked. And we have our old friend Raza Rumi here. He knows the price of bravery. I'm sure when he was doing his job, he was sort of, you know, he was doing his job. He wasn't getting up every morning, getting ready to go to his office and thinking that, oh, how brave I am, that I'm going to go and say this thing on TV. You try and be, you know, sort of, you try and do the job that you've chosen for yourself, or the fate has chosen for you, or the circumstances have brought to you. You don't really think whether, you know, sort of, you're brave or you're coward and you're courageous. I've had far too many friends who've died or been killed, and later it has been said about them that they were very brave. And I know for a fact that they were, you know, sort of as brave as any of you, if given a choice to live and to be called, you know, sort of not brave. I don't know. I tend to think that they would have said that, okay, no, today I'm not going to be brave. Today I'm going to be myself, normal, because I want to wake up tomorrow in my own bed and not in Cornell, like Raza Rumi does these days. So I think most people would think like that. So I think, you know, it makes me very happy when somebody says that, oh, you're really sensible. But hardly anybody ever says that.
So,
yeah, or if somebody says that, oh, you really occasionally you write a good sentence, that's that kind of gives you. But brave, like when somebody calls you brave, I really get shit scared. I'm like, you know, shit, whatever I'm doing, I must stop. So that's not a good, don't remind me of that.
We can say observant.
Yes, question.
Now, I'm out of touch, but can you keep us up to date on where the exploding mangoes really came from? What's the current state of thought on this?
On the book or the
real world events?
Real world events. Everybody's forgotten about it, no? I mean, nobody really cares. We have these sort of After every 10, 20 years, we have these military dictators who come in. And they're there like for about 9, 10, 11 years. And somehow people get bored with them. I mean, they don't have the kind of staying power that some of the Middle Eastern or your neighbor Cuban rulers have. I mean, they just kind of, you know, they're just not, they just don't have the staying power after 9, 10 years. So there are ways to kind of get rid of them. So in this particular case, it was quite dramatic. The last dictator that we had, Musharraf, we kind of did it in the old-fashioned way. People came out on the streets. We kind of made fun of him. There were lots of jokes and songs about him. But with General Zia, it wasn't possible because he was one of a kind. So somebody took care of that. So his plane. And it's quite shocking and scary, actually, that somebody who runs one of the sort of largest professional armies in the world, with your country's ambassador and another diplomat, they're all in a plane, and the plane blows up, and then nobody cares, nobody wants to find out what happened, like why, who. So there were like half-hearted inquiries after that. But even their own families, I think, these people who died, these generals, their own sons, they were in government more than once. But they never bothered to pressurize the government or the investigation agencies that find out who did it. And it is quite obvious that the United States government at that time and their various investigating agencies, they were very keen to cover it up. So they were cover ups that went on for a bit. So it's quite scary that somebody dies and nobody actually wants to know who killed them. It's fascinating, isn't it? And it's kind of tells us something about the kind of world we live in, sometimes tells us about the kind of people that we've had to deal with, that we say, good riddance, like, you know, well done, you know, sort of, let's move on. We don't want to know who did this. But my personal, because I think the company that makes these planes, C-130s, what's it called? Douglas Smart? No, it's a no. It's not. It's the other one. They're C-130. The company that, yeah, you can go home and Google it. Yeah. So they had their own investigation. They were saying no, it's not a technical failure, and then there was an FBI team just saying, oh no, it's a technical failure. So everybody was kind of trying to do their own thing. If you want to know my personal, a very personal theory, without any kind of, without any evidence to back it up. It probably was a mechanical failure. Something, you know, aircrafts are, you know, machines, and they kind of, and that's a real possibility. But you really can't write a 300-page long book about a wire breaking in the, you know, in an aeroplane. It doesn't go very far. Yeah. So you try and believe like the other stuff. Yes.
With all of that, are you optimistic about the future of the world?
No.
I wonder if you have a book in mind for the demise of Benazir.
No, not really. It's too. It's well, kind of too fresh and too tragic and too sad. But as Dadi Saab said, I am working with a composer, so we're doing an opera on Bhutto and Benazir's life. So that will probably cover some of it. Yeah, but not a book, not that I've thought of. But other people have written books about Benazir's life and her assassination.
Question back there.
You chose to write a lot about urban Karachi. Do you think you would have written differently had you still been staying in London or in a different sort of context?
Interesting. I haven't thought about it. No, I've kind of lived in both places, but Karachi, I've kind of almost grew up in Karachi, in the sense that I was the first time that I came to a big city, and it was a huge cultural shock. So coming from a small village to Karachi is like, you know, if you can deal with that kind of shock, then, you know, sort of you can deal with many things later in life. Yeah, no, I wish I had written more on Karachi, and I probably will write more about Karachi. But yeah, since that's where I've spent like most of my youth and have made friends and enemies and kind of, you know, so those kind of places become part of your life and your sort of mental landscape. So you would say.
Thank you for your beautiful reading. I'm a little more familiar with the debates within the Indian context about Indian writing in English versus Indian writing in the vernacular.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could comment some, as someone who's writing in English and in Urdu, about the different kinds of literary cultures that you're writing in and to in the Pakistani context and its diasporas on this question of the language.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there is a sort of a valid question somewhere that gets discussed a lot, especially in academic circles and within critics. But I don't really have an answer to that. It's like, why do you write in one language and not the other language? So I write like. I write in Urdu and occasionally I've dabbled into Punjabi as well, which is my mother tongue. I write fiction in English because when I was growing up, you read as you know, sort of, that's where your inspiration comes from. Your book comes from other books that you've read as much as from life that you've lived. So most of the books that I read, it just so happened that even if they were originally written in Russian or Spanish or whatever language, I read them in English translation. So most of your most of fiction that you've read in your life happened to be in English. So I think that kind of somehow prepares your mind for writing in English. It's like kids who kind of, you know, make a band when they're young. And they're kind of into one kind of music. So the chances are that if they ever kind of pursue it seriously, that's what they're going to do. So that is my personal, and I write in Urdu, mostly nonfiction or journalism, because that's more immediate, you know, sort of you just want to kind of, you know, let people know on the day that what's wrong with them. So that works better in Urdu. You also have a sort of slightly clearer idea that who is going to be reading this. Whereas with novels, it's like, I mean, I really have no clue that who will or will not read when you're writing it. So in a way, you're free from that kind of pressure. And a simple answer in the end would be that you write in English because you want to make some money, I mean, like a living. you want to feed your children because there really is not much money in kind of writing Urdu fiction, that people kind of have to do other things to, you know, to support their their pursuit of writing Urdu, and I am kind of too lazy. It's bad enough, like just doing one thing. So then to write novels and then to kind of do something else to kind of support that habit, that's too much. That's yeah. Yes. Toss. Please keep sitting.
Yeah. Do not underestimate yourself. Pain is stronger than sword, and many changes for better happen in Indian society because of stronger writers and the producers and the moviegoers. It does make change for better. So don't underestimate your power. Write books.
I'll have a conversation with Raza after this.
Yes.
Do
you
feel yourself being pressurized to kind of explain Pakistan or Karachi in your writing, because you are from this part of the world and you're ostensibly your writing is for a global audience?
Yeah. And the question is that, Do I feel pressure to explain Pakistan and Karachi to an audience? Yes, especially sort of in American colleges where you know, sort of you can just go and read some newspapers and you'll find out what's happening in Karachi. I mean, or Pakistan. But somehow it's expected that. But I think it's sometimes it's a legitimate curiosity. But I live and work in Karachi, so I think not just outside. Even when I go to my hometown, which is like, you know, which is not Karachi, I was there like 2 weeks ago, and I've been going there for 20 years, 25 years. And first thing everybody asks me is, "What is wrong with your city? What is happening there? When will it become better?" And they are like Pakistanis, like my own family, and they know that I live there, like, you know, sort of I have always lived there. So their curiosity is kind of, you know, sometimes as bad as like any outsider's curiosity. And sometimes even living in Karachi, people ask each other, "What the hell is going on? what's happened?" Like last month, the prices of water and beer doubled. And I've been going around asking, what happened? And nobody knows. Everybody has a different explanation. So sometimes when things are not, you know, not in the public domain, when you don't know, like, who has done what or what has caused this, I think it's kind of legitimate that people ask each other, even within the city, that, you know, sort of what has happened. But yeah, but you're right. Sometimes there is this expectation that somehow a writer will have answers to you know, sort of to the problems of a country or a city. And some writers do. I don't. I mean, I.
Yes.
So I actually have a totally nerdy question first in that vein. For 5 years I've wondered, there was a co-authored piece in the Granta special issue, how to write about Pakistan. Did you write the first mango list?
Yeah, I did. Okay. You figure that out. Yeah.
Substantive question was, you work in all of these different media, right? Mm. Radio plays, now you're working on an opera, and you know, your prose fiction, and not to mention your other non-fictional writings. Do you see them feeding into each other, these various media, and their different audiences?
I'm sure they do. In fact, while I was reading this, because one rarely reads one's own things, like, you know, once you've written it, it's gone, it's gone. So I was reading, so I found, I just read a piece about snow leopard, and then there was a snow leopard in the fiction bit that I was reading. So I'm sure I'm kind of constantly stealing from myself. That probably it just occurred to me. It hadn't kind of occurred to me. I was thinking, what, another snow leopard? Like two snow leopards in one evening? That's a bit much. So I'm sure all of these things, but I don't know how, though. I mean, I'm sure they kind of, you know, sort of, they feed off each other. You can't really, I really wouldn't know. I don't believe in mumbo jumbo. I'm a straightforward person. You know, when you sit down, you know that you're going to write a 1,000-word piece for one newspaper, and you do that. And when you sit down to write a sort of a song, for a composer. You've already discussed it. You know that. But I think in all of that, there's you. Like some of you goes into whatever you sit down to do, as some very famous American writer said, that basically all the characters that you create and all the kind of different. So basically, you're just trying to channel your own madness. So these are all kind of various mad bits of you that kind of keep reappearing, like in various forms. Yeah.
Yeah. Question.
Lots of school children too along with this novel.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well.
Question though. You know, you talk a little bit about the exploding mangoes, but could you talk a little bit about where the idea for Alice Bhatti came from? What madness got channeled?
I remember this moment from my young days when my mother she had cancer and she was in hospital in her last days. So I was staying with her for the last couple of weeks. So I don't know about hospitals here, but their hospitals are like, you know, their complete world of their own. Like, you know, somebody's being born and somebody's kind of in pain and somebody's dying. But I do remember like in that hospital room, waking up like at 3 or 4 in the morning, just when you're half asleep, half awake. And this image of this nurse kind of bent over my mother, like fixing something, I'm not quite sure what. And I think what happens is that when you're going through that kind of grief, you try and kind of block out the real kind of the real bad stuff that's happening. So I even when I try, I can't remember my mother's face during her last days. But I do remember these other details around her. So that image kind of stayed with me, and I was genuinely very impressed. Although she was just doing her job, but I was like, it's like 4 a.m. There are no supervisors. There is like, you know, nobody's asking her to do it. But here she is. She's like taking care of my sick mother, like on all her own. So I don't know. So that image stayed with me like for about 20 years, and I never knew what to do with it. What it kind of means. So I think that's where it actually. That was the origins. That's where it went back to. I wanted to imagine her, you know, sort of. It was just kind of a bit perverse. Like you remember somebody from 20 years ago. Why are you now, as a middle-aged man, sitting there obsessing about dreaming up a life for them? So I wasn't sure. Lots of the time, is it sort of a valid artistic exercise to kind of sit and imagine a working woman's life, her love life? Is it like? But yeah, I stuck with it for a few years. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. But that's where it kind of came from. Yeah.
I enjoyed the book.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
If may I just add something?
Mm-hmm.
You said that you don't believe in the. You are not optimistic about the future of the world.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt the world is in a mess. What I would say is let us not individually contribute to this mess.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do the best we can to bring in a little happiness.
Yeah, that's what I tell my children, but they don't listen to me. I don't know what's wrong.
They are too young to understand.
But is it true? In fact, my son, who's applying to universities now, he told me, and this is a genuine question, I'm not. Is like Cornell a really depressing place? No, he told me that it's on some chart, there is some rating. of campus depressions, and he said he's right up there. I assured him that I was there, going to be there only for a day, so you shouldn't worry.
But
is it true? Is it true?
To answer that in person when you go back.
Is it true? No, but or is it one of those internet myths? I don't know. He read it somewhere. And I was like, you know, what kind of young man goes on the internet looking for the world's America's top depressing places? Sorry? Oh, okay. So we are in a good month. We can be optimistic. We can be optimistic this month. Yes? Winter.
A teacher can make better students, and the better students become better citizens. Good writer can become better readers, and through readers, progress will come.
I'm
don't
sure.
Be disappointed I'm, about future.
I'm sure it will come. If the people should keep buying my books, I think that's the only way to save the world.
Young men should be not give up. No.
No, I'm. Does it seem I'm giving up? No.
No.
I'm standing right here.
Just realistic.
Travel 24 hours to be with you guys. So not yet.
So I just want to mention that this is the 7th in the Rabindranath Tagore Modern Literature Lecture Series. The inaugural lecture was held in 2009 with Sunil Gangopadhyaya speaking on Tagore's involvement with the Indian independence movement. The subsequent speakers were Kiran Nagarkar from Bombay, Tamima Anam from Bangladesh and England, Christy Merrill from the University of Michigan, Amit Chaudhary from Calcutta and England, and Manjushri Thapa from Nepal and Toronto. Today we have had Muhammad Hanif from Pakistan. The director of the South Asia program was Dan Gold at the starting of the series, and I owe him a debt of gratitude for his patience with my views about this series. I have some strong views. While Dan was on sabbatical leave, Durba Ghosh was the acting director. Since then, Anne Blackburn has been the director. It was Anne who expanded the scope of this lecture series. Anne had planned to invite an author from Sri Lanka, but the political problems there prevented it. This year, Anne is away, who is right here. Don't tell anybody. Away on a research grant, and Iftikhar Dadi is the interim director. So far, we have covered the Indian subcontinent, and now there is a need to go beyond. My own idea is to invite writers from the Middle East, Iran, Israel, etc. I am not familiar with the more recent literature from Iran, but I have read a great deal of Israel literature, beginning with Shalom Aleichem, pen name, Nam Diplum, Isaac Bashevis Singer, and others. In fact, when I was visiting Poland, I met somebody on the bus. I mentioned Isaac Bashevis Singer to that person. That person corrected my pronunciation. It is Zinger. I wish to thank several people here, including Bill Fallon, the South Asia Program Manager, and his associate, Durga Bor, without whom a program like this would not be possible. Before that, I'm quoting from memory a poem that it says that, forget the name, author's name, "The world is in a mess, my friend. Perhaps it will improve. What you can do is to accept the universe and turn it inside and make it your own. That's where we belong." Thank you.
Today is October 2nd, when Gandhiji was born, who believed in doing no harm to other people on the basis that humans have the ability to differentiate between doing right and wrong. I hope at least in near future, educated people will carry out this principle to everybody.